Yeah. Okay, folks, a couple of reminders in case you need them. This is going to sound like piling on, but maybe, and maybe it is. Your mystery project is due day after tomorrow by 5 o'clock. Next Monday is the third and final quiz, right? Hey, don't look at me that way. The end of the semester is coming. I have like 5 sessions left. Everything's going to pile on top of everything else. You have a final project, you have a final exam. So basically, you have 4 things left on the calendar. They're all going to come at you fast. But first, get your mystery project into me. Make sure you put that no mystery here in the subject line so I can put it in the right folder. And make sure you carbon copy, is that the right word? CC, everybody in your group. Okay? And put your names on the front page. So, sometime by Wednesday at 5 o'clock. But if you get done earlier, get it into me as soon as you can. I will put up the review session for the third quiz up after this class, so you'll have enough time to review it. So it's going to be pretty much everything through the end of packet 2, which we will complete today, but nothing from what we do on Wednesday. So it'll, you know, you'll be pretty much ready after today to do the reviews and do the quiz 3. So today we're going to complete our discussion of valuing private businesses. And we talked a little bit about some of the entanglements that you run into. But today we're going to look at one aspect of private company valuation where we actually kind of get into the border between private and public companies. And that is in valuing IPOs. So I want to focus in today on valuing initial public offerings or pricing them, and we'll talk about the contracts. So let's say you're an investment bank. Your job is to take a company public, and I'm the company that's come to you. You've done an intrinsic valuation of the company and come up with a value per share of $10 per share. So if this sounds too abstract, give this IPO a name, Snap, whatever, you know, the new company that's coming, Palantir. So you come up with an intrinsic value of $10 per share. Okay? You do a pricing of the same company, right? And based on how other companies are being priced, the pricing you come up with is $25. So you have two numbers here. $10 comes from an intrinsic valuation of the company, $25 from the pricing. If you're the banker and you have to set the offering price, you know what the offering price is? The price that you're going to be offering the shares to people so that they get the shares on the opening day. Is the offering price going to be based on your intrinsic value of $10 per share or your pricing of $25 per share? Anna, what do you think? And why? Let's play the game out. I'm the company. You're my banker. When I came to you to take me public, I said, put a number on me. Why is a pricing number the better number to put on if your job is to take me public?
Because this is like what price people are willing to pay.
Exactly. In fact, if you set the number at the intrinsic value, you know what's going to happen, right? All those people who get the shares at $10 are now going to walk away with this $15 profit. And your job as a banker is not to value companies, but to price them. And that's something I've talked about before. But that's why valuing an IPO is almost an oxymoron. You price an IPO because your job as a banker is to get the best possible price for me. Okay? Which means the tools you should be using to put a number on my company are more pricing tools, right? Multiples and comparables rather than traditional discounted cash flow valuation. So let's say that you decide $25 is what you can price the company. The way most IPO agreements with investment banks work is you get an underwriting guarantee. You know what an underwriting guarantee is? Once I set the price, I guarantee you that price. And if I don't deliver that price, I have to make up the difference. So I want you to put yourself in my shoes as a banker. I have a $25 price, and we've already decided that that's what I should put the offering price at. Should I set my offering price at $25, above $25, or below $25, given the guarantee that I've given you? Luis? And tell me why.
Because you want to be safe and not risk your own money.
In other words, exactly right. From my perspective, you can see why I wanted to set it below. It makes my job easier first. And by making my job easier, I'm going to still collect the commission. So I'm going to set it below. Shouldn't I be pissed off as a company because you've set it below? Let's see if that's true. Okay? You're the founder, owner of the company. Let's say that that bankers have valued the company or priced the company at 20 and they price it at 15 because it makes their job easier. I've, in a sense, left $5 per share on the table as the owner, right? Should I go along with this plan as a founder owner? Doesn't it look like I'm the guy who's paying for this underpricing? What do you think, Fernando? If this were your startup, and I price your company at 20, and I take it public at 15, are you going to push back and say, no, you should push the offering price up? But the people who got the shares at 15 are the ones who are going to benefit, right? So when the price goes up to 20, you as the owner now no longer get that increase. It's going to be the people you sold the shares to at 15. If you were selling all 100% of your shares, this is a lot to leave on the table. You've given away, in a sense, you've given away a quarter of your company for nothing, right? But let's say I offered only 12% of your shares in the initial offering, which is often what you see in most IPOs. Might your calculus change? It's that on the 12% you're losing, right? But what do you hope to get in return? That Wall Street Journal article the next day, and what is it going to say? XYZ company stock price jumps on offering day. And what do you hope that'll do? Bring in fresh suckers into the game, right? Who are going to read the story and say, oh my God, I got left out of that snap IPO. I need to jump in now. And eventually you're going to try to sell your shares 6 months or a year from now. You're hoping that the good mood lasts then so that when you sell the shares later, that because you underpriced the IPO, you're able to get a higher price. It's like a loss leader in a retail store. You know what loss leaders are in retail stores? You walk into a department store. There's usually a table up in front with sales items, things that are selling way below cost. So you can buy a t-shirt for $1.50. You're saying, this is great. They're selling it at below cost, right? You're saying, that's stupid. Why would they do it? Because by the time you make table after table and you get into the middle of the store, it's too late for you to leave. So now you start buying the polo stuff that's right next to it at 50% above what you should be paying. Lost leaders are designed to bring people in with the hope that once you come in, you will buy other stuff that will make you money. And that's exactly the way to think about IPOs. Let's finish the story. So we've seen why bankers underprice IPOs. We've seen why founders might go along with the underpricing. Let's now close the process by thinking like investors. I'm going to show you some evidence today that a typical IPO is underpriced by about 15%. So on the offering day, you generally get on average a jump of 15%. So let's say that statistic is well established, and it is. As an investor, could you think of a way of trying to make money on it? And once you think of that way, I'm going to push back and look at some of the reasons it might not work. So what seems an easy way to make money? What should you do? Try to buy 1,000 shares of every IPO. Wait for the offering day. See the stock price jump. And you should be rich, right? You make a 15%. Tell me why that strategy is not going to work. Because people have tried it. It doesn't seem to work in practice. Whereas every study seems to find a 15% jump on average on an IPO price. Why is trying to buy 1,000 shares of every IPO not delivering the returns that you see on paper in these IPO studies? So how does it work when you want 1,000 shares of an IPO? When the investment banker puts out these offerings, you ask for 1,000 shares. Barbara, what? Okay, so let's carry that to the next step, right? So let's say you have 100 IPOs. Let's say 10 are overpriced and 90 are underpriced. So the typical IPO is underpriced, but 10 are overpriced. You ask for 1,000 shares of all 100. Are you going to get 1,000 shares just because you asked for it? So the banker will decide how many shares to give you based on the demand for the IPO, right? So guess which 10 companies you're going to get all 1,000 shares in? All the overpriced. And in the underpriced ones, instead of getting 1,000 shares, you're going to get 300, 400, 250 shares. So when you look at your overall portfolio, guess what it's going to look like? It's going to be overweighted in the overpriced IPOs and underweighted in the underpriced IPOs. You're not going to make the rates of return you see on paper. And this is part of a more general statement I'll make. There are all these studies you will read in finance about how easy it is to make money in the market. You buy small cap stocks, you make money. You buy low price to book stocks, you make money. You buy IPO, because on paper, I can show you that these strategies all make money. There's many a slip between the cup and the lip. What you see on that paper reflects things that you cannot do in the real world, because when you try to do them, you run into this, I call it a market friction. Nothing is as easy in practice as it looks on paper. So today, as we talk about IPOs, we're going to talk about the process of valuing IPOs. We're going to look at why bankers underprice IPOs. We're also going to look at why it's difficult to make money of that underpricing because of the nature of the IPO process. So let's close this up, go to the end of packet two, page 141 is where we were. So let's review where we are with private company valuation. Okay? So let's assume you're trying to buy a private business from me. Let's start check with the checklist. I show you my income statement. What are some of the questions you need to ask me if it's a private company that you would not have asked me as a public company? I can think of at least two. You might add more to that. What are some of the questions? It's a private company valuation, so basically you got an income statement, just like on a public company. But what are some of the questions? Would you ask me about salaries? In fact, if you're going to ask me about salaries, what's the question you're going to ask? Do I pay myself a salary? Why is it important? Because I might show a profit from this business, but I might be working like a dog 18 hours a day. You buy this business because it looks like it's making money, and the day after you buy the business, you don't feel like working like a dog. You have to hire people to work like dogs for you. All of a sudden, that profit becomes either zero or a loss. So the first question you're going to ask me is, hey, am I paying myself a salary? And if I'm not, what should you do? Put in a salary that will cost you to replace. So you have to find out what I do. So ask me questions. What do you do every day? Because you might have to hire a janitor, because I actually do everything that a janitor does. You might have to hire a cashier. You might have to hire an inventory keeper. So that's the first question. Any other questions you might ask? Remember we talked about key person? What's the question you'd like to ask me about this key person issue? In other words, you could ask, how personal is this business, right? Because if it's a very personal business, that people are coming in because they like me, because they know me, you could buy this business, it could look immensely profitable, but the day after you buy it, you could open the doors and nobody's coming in. So you might not even have to ask me, just looking at the business, you know, some businesses are more personal than others. If I'm trying to sell you a retail store, the key person is less critical than if I'm trying to sell you a doctor's practice. Because as a doctor's practice, it's not coming to get medicine practiced on me. This is a particular doctor that I have a relationship with. So you're going to ask me about key persons. You're going to ask about ghost employees. You want to know how many George Costanzas there are on my rolls. People who are there, who I pay money to as a salary, but don't seem to show up. You want to make sure before you use those numbers that these are actually the cash flows you will generate as the owner of the private business. So those are the cash flow checklist. Next, let's look at the discount rate. When you look at the discount rate for a private company, what do we say was the key factor, the first thing you have to worry about? Is you have a beta that you can get from public companies. You can say, why don't I look at other private companies? There's nothing you'll find out about other private companies. So everything we know about discount rates comes from looking at public companies. And the way we come up with the cost of equity and capital for a public company is we assume that the only risk that matters is the risk you cannot diversify away. We assume if it's a public company, investors can diversify away the risk. We use a beta, cost of equity, cost of debt, cost of capital, we're done. With a private company, when you're looking at the company, what do you need to look at also? So what else is in your portfolio? If you're going to take your entire wealth and invest it in this company, we talked about what you need to do. You need to adjust your beta for the fact that you're exposed to the rest of the risk in the company, not just the public company risk, which means your beta is going to get scaled up. That's what I call the total beta. And that beta scaling up is going to push up your cost of equity and cost of capital and push down the value of your private business. So I want to finish the process here by talking about one final issue that you run into with private businesses. And it's much more dangerous in a private business than in a public company. If you watch Jim Cramer on CNBC, the guy is, I think, insane. He puts out like 100 recommendations in 30 minutes. You can't even keep track. Buy this, sell this, buy this, sell this. Let's say in a moment of insanity, you listen to him. And you actually buy 1,000 shares of Tesla. He says, Tesla, buy Tesla now. I think he's short of Tesla, but let's say you buy whatever he says. A minute after you buy it, maybe even not even a minute, you hit the buy on your computer, the 1,000 shares get bought. You can see it happening in front of you. And your rational side rears its head and says, what the hell did you just do? You say, okay, I've got to get out of these shares now. You sell the 1,000 shares instantaneously. So basically, you bought it at 330, you sold it at 331. Do you bear a cost? Let's say the stock price didn't change. So what you see on the ticker says IBM, whatever the price was a minute ago, Tesla, whatever the price was, still the price. But is there a cost to what you just did? Let's start with the easy one. Do any of you have a brokerage account? No? Fidelity, Schwab? Fernando, you look rich. Right. Do you have a brokerage account?
No.
No, okay. So anybody have a brokerage account? You don't know? You do, okay. Who do you use? How much do they charge per trade? $5 a trade. So basically, at the minimum, you're going to get, and $5 on each side, so you're going to have a $10. Is there any other cost we face, though, besides that? The bid ask. Explain to me what the bid ask is.
You'll send an order in, and the brokerage will actually get a spread on the difference between your ask and what they're buying at.
In fact, when you see that ticker tape go on the bottom, it's actually the trade price that you're seeing there. And what you see as the reported price for a stock is actually not the price at which you can buy or sell. There's a spread around that. When you buy, you have to buy at the higher price. When you sell, you have to sell at the lower price. That spread, even if the stock price doesn't change, will be a cost to you. You're saying, how big can that be? For a stock like IBM, it's trivial. It's 0.1%. It used to be that in the old days on the New York Stock Exchange, spreads were always in eighths and quarters. In fact, this was a big scandal because with large cap stocks, because you couldn't go to below 1/8, they were making money. So that's now changed. You can now have it in decimal points. So on a stock like IBM, you might have a spread of 10 cents on a $100 stock. It's almost nothing. But that's part of the cost too. You're saying, so why are we talking about it if it's almost nothing? That's if you bought IBM. Let's assume that the stock that Jim Cramer screamed out was actually some small NASDAQ stock with a very light, not much volume on it. The spread on that stock can be so basically if you buy it can be $2, you sell instantaneously. 1 second later, it can be $1.50. But with public companies, that's your illiquidity discount, right? The illiquidity discount is the price you're paying for remorse. For being said, I shouldn't have done that. Now do you see why with private businesses, this is upped in spades? Let's say on your way out today, you actually have some money you've saved. Because let's say you got a scholarship and you haven't paid this exorbitant tuition that NYU charges you. So you save some money. On your way out, in a moment of weakness, you stop at that corner grocery store. Or actually at the hot dog stand outside and you buy the stand. Don't ask me why. It's impulse buy. You've taken your entire savings and done what? Bought a hot dog stand because there was a line outside and said, this looks like a good investment to me. 10 seconds later, you change your mind. What are you going to have to do? You're going to have to try to sell a hot dog stand. So what are you going to do? Hang out outside the hot dog stand as people come and say, would you like to buy my stand? Oh. You can already see why selling a private business is going to be much more expensive, much more involved, which means when you buy a private business up front, you have to start demanding what's called an illiquidity discount. Just in case I'm wrong, you're not admitting defeat up front, but you have to build it into your price. I'm going to take some money off the value because if I change my mind, it's going to be so difficult to back out of this investment. So that's the last thing I want to talk about with private company, a private to private company valuation, is how much should that discount be? I'll describe how it works right now in practice. I still remember the first time I ever talked to a group of private company appraisers was about 25 years ago. This was a big conference of private company appraisers. So I show up and give my usual spiel on valuation and ask them, what's going on for the rest of the 2 days? And I look at the list of topics they have, and half of what they're going to be talking about is the liquidity discount. So I said, what do you guys do about this fact that companies are illiquid? They said, we knock 20 to 25% off our valuation for every company. And that made no sense to me, and here's why. Let's assume that I give you two different companies. They're both private companies. The first company is a money-making company with a long history and an established clientele. The second company is a young growth company with a lot of things to prove and a lot of potential. Which of these two companies would you demand a larger liquidity discount on? Are you going to apply a larger discount on the healthy money-making company or the young startup, which is potentially, no, which has lots of potential but is still losing money? I would expect the second company to have a much bigger discount than the first one, because in the first one, you don't even have to sell the company to collect cash flows, right? It's making money for you. So I'd expect the discount to vary across companies. Do you expect the discount to vary across buyers? So let's say you have a business to sell, and you have two potential buyers. One is this buyer who has lots of capital, doesn't need much cash on a day-to-day basis, and has a long time horizon. The other is a buyer who is very interested in your company, but is much more on the edge. They might need more capital quickly. The first buyer is going to attach a much smaller discount to your company than the second buyer. Why? Because they care less about liquidity. I've talked a lot about this in the context of Warren Buffett and earlier in this class. One of the things that I think he brings to the table that gives him an advantage in investing is he's investing insurance company money. You're saying, so what? The actuarial tables don't panic on you. So you know exactly when you need cash. You don't need liquidity in a hurry. It's not like your clients pull money out. So if you run a mutual fund, you never know when your investors will panic and demand their money back. But if you're investing insurance company money, you care less about liquidity. So what does this mean? In periods where liquidity is highly priced, people want it at all costs, what does Warren Buffett do? He sells liquidity. He says, okay, you guys want liquidity, I'll sell it to you. I'll hold these shares because I don't need liquidity right now. Which brings me to my third and final point. If you're trying to sell a private business, the time at which you're trying to sell it matters. And here's why. Let's say you were trying to sell a private business in November of 2008. This is at the height of that crisis, right? The discount you would have to put on the business would be huge because people said, I want cash. I don't want to invest in any business. That's when Warren Buffett made some of his biggest investments. Is he bought Goldman Sachs, November 1st of 2008. He bought Bank of America, October 15th of 2008. He bought them because it was a crisis. People were demanding these huge discounts, even on public companies. They say, you know what? I'll buy those stocks at a discount. So my problem with private company appraisers is not that they attach a discount. I understand that. But why that discount is the same for every company beats me, why it doesn't change over time, strikes me as strange. And why it doesn't seem to reflect who the potential buyer is doesn't make any sense. And I'll tell you, of all the things I struggle with in valuation, this is the one that to me is the most unresolved, where I have the fewest good answers. So I'm going to throw out what I do. And I'm not satisfied with any of the things I do to adjust for liquidity. So if you can come up with a clever way of adjusting for liquidity, I'm willing to listen. So here's the first way in which people have tried to estimate how much of a discount there should be. What they look for are investments or assets where you can actually observe how much the liquidity discount is. Here's what I mean by this. When you watch private companies being bought and sold, you observe the price, right? You observe the actual price. So you don't know what the discount was because all you observe is the price. So here are two scenarios where you might be able to observe the discount, though albeit with some noise. With most publicly traded stocks, when they want to issue new shares, you go to the SEC, you file for approval, and then you issue the shares to the broad market. That's the way most companies raise new equity. But there's a way in which the SEC allows you to bypass the process. Not have to file a prospectus, not have to go through the process. It's called the restricted stock issue. So here's how it works. You're a public company. Your stock is trading at $10 per share. You need to raise $100 million. You go out and you make restricted stock issues. But here's the restriction. With these restricted stock issues, because you didn't go through the SEC approval process, the people buying these shares are not allowed to trade them for, it used to be 2 years, now it's 1 year. So these are publicly traded stocks. The stock price right now is $10. I place this restricted stock issue with you. So you're buying the shares in my company. But I also tell you, look, you know, if you buy these shares, you can't trade them for the next 2 years. Would you pay more than $10, $10 or less than $10 for the share? Come on, this is the, you'll pay less than $10. Why? Because I'm tying your hands. Because if you bought into the public marketplace for $10, you can sell the shares. By buying this restricted stock issue, you're going to demand. And you can actually observe these restricted stock issues and what they're being priced at and compare it to the $10. So if you say, look, I'll pay $9, what's the discount you're demanding for 2 years of illiquidity? A 10% discount. So I'm going to talk about what people have found by looking at restricted stock issues, because that's often the basis for this 20 to 25% discount. Here's the second way in which you can observe the discount. Remember when Snap first announced that it was going for an IPO? It's like 4 months before the actual IPO. Then there's this elaborate dance they went through before the final offering. So here's what people have taken to doing. They take IPOs like Snap. They look at the 4 to 6 months before the IPO. And they look to see whether there have been any transactions between the owners of the company. So let's say you and I are owners of a company. We're planning an IPO in 4 months, and the IPO is going to be at $15. And I come to you and say, look, you know, would you sell me your 50%? Now, you can sell me the 50%, and you have to set the price. Remember, the IPO price, the expected price is $15. But I'm letting you cash out 4 months ahead of the IPO. Would you demand $15, less than $15? I mean, so if you think about it from both sides, what do you think you're going to get for these shares? Less than 15, 15, or more than 15? Your expected IPO is in 4 months, $15. Keyword is expected. What am I offering you? Cash today to kind of cash out. My guess is most of us would say, look, you know, if you offer me $14, I don't have to deal with the uncertainty of whether the IPO will go through. So, in fact, there are the second set of studies. Look at transactions pre-IPOs. Look at the pricing on these transactions and compare them to the IPO price. So I'm going to show you what the numbers look like. And you tell me whether you actually believe these numbers, because I don't. Private company appraisers show these as studies all the time. They show up in court and say, hey, the IPO study, the restricted stock study. The studies that look at restricted stocks actually find that, on average, the discount on restricted stock is about 30 to 35%. So the example that I gave you, the $10 stock price, you're actually paying $6.50 to $7 to get those shares. Astonishingly big discount for not trading for 2 years. Most of these studies just look at the average across the entire sample, which struck me as, no, you're throwing away a lot of data. It's like using the average PE. So about 10 years ago, maybe longer than that, 20 years ago, Bill Silber, who teaches at Stern, said, look, we have these restricted stock issues. There are discounts, and the discounts seem to vary across companies. So he said, let's see why the discount is smaller in some companies and larger in others. So he looked across the sample, and he ran a regression on the restricted stock price as a percentage of the actual price. So think of that as 1 minus the discount. So all the signs have to be reversed in your head. And he found that the larger the revenues of the company, the smaller the discount. Bigger companies have smaller discounts. He found that if you're making money, that de-earn is actually a measure of, are you making money or losing money? It's a dummy variable. He found that companies who were making money had smaller discounts than companies who were losing money. Okay. He also found that if you, as an investor, were also a customer of the company, that the discount tended to be smaller. You're saying, why would that be? Because as a customer, there are other ways I might be giving you benefits. So at the end of the process, he had this regression where if you tell me what kind of company you are, you could tell me why the restricted stock discount varied across companies. But let me step back. You're a company, you make restricted stock issues, you're giving up like 15, 20, 25% for making a restricted stock issue, right? So why would you do that? Why would a company bypass the SEC approval process and go through this and leave so much money on the table? What are the reasons you think they do it? One is they're desperate, and second is they need money in a hurry. So when I look at a restricted stock study, this study is already biased, right? Because the types of companies that make restricted stock offerings are not healthy, normal companies. They're companies that are off the table already. So I'm finding a big liquidity discount here, but this is exactly the kind of company where the discount should be large. And if I take this 30 to 35% discount and apply it in a nice, healthy company, I'm leaving too much money on the table. So that's the first restricted stock issues. And one of the things I actually do is I take that 20 to 25% discount and say, let me at least finesse this number for you. And what I mean by that, if you look at the Silber study, what did you find? Companies with higher revenues have smaller discounts than companies with lower revenues. In the silver study, you find that companies that make money have smaller discounts than companies that lose money. So what I did in this graph was I said, you tell me how much you have as revenues as a company and whether you're making money. I'll use a restricted stock discount, but at least I'll use it with some finesse. And here's what I mean by this. If you're a company with $1 billion in revenues, you're a big private business, which is making money. If I plug the numbers into that silver regression, the predicted discount I get for you is about 16%. It's not 25, it's 16. Why is it lower? Because you're big revenues, you're making money. If you're a small money-losing company, $5 million in revenues, and you're losing money, your discount could be as high as 34%. So if you want to stay in that restricted stock world, I can at least finesse it and say, this company should have a 34% discount, but this one should have only a 16% discount. But they're all based on a sample that is flawed, which is this restricted stock sample of companies that are a little off the normal path. Let's talk about IPOs. Okay? And this is where I want you to ask some questions about whether you would do this if you were a co-owner of a business. But what I'm doing here, I'm looking at the 6 months before the IPO. I'm looking for transactions between owners. I'm looking at the price you're asking on that transaction and comparing it to the actual IPO price. So in the case of Snap, I think what the IPO price was $22. Or it started at 17 and then let's even take let's round it out to $20 per share. I look at the 6 months before the IPO. I find any transactions where VC sold to each other or Evan Spiegel bought from somebody. I look at the price on that transaction. Then I compare the two prices. This is what the studies find. On average, the discount, as you look across them, is about 40 to 50%. Do you really believe that? Would you do this? Would you sell your shares at half what you think the expected IPO price will be in the 6 months? This is not 6 years before the IPO, in the 6 months before. There's a statistical flaw in all of these studies. And I want you to tell me what it is. Because clearly, this number makes no sense. What is it that's causing this discount to be so big here? Yes. But why are you selling to me then? I can understand why the person buying it is doing it, right? But why are you selling for such a... I can understand there's being a discount. My question is, why is it 40 to 50%? That sounds like an immense... You're leaving like billions of dollars on the table. Yes? Carry that through. Does every company that plans an IPO actually have an IPO? No. In fact, if you take all companies that are planning IPOs 6 months before the IPO and you track them, about a third of all companies don't do their IPO because bad things happen. Something bad happens, they pull the IPO back. Now do you see where the flaw in the studies? What do they start with? They look at the two-thirds that actually complete their IPOs and they work backwards. What are you missing? If you really want to do this right, you got to bring in the other one-third, which never got the IPO done, and there you sold your shares at 50% above what these guys could actually end up getting because these were the IPOs that got pulled for really bad reasons. Is there a discount for selling before an IPO? Absolutely. I don't think it's even close to 50% or 40%. But he's saying, so why do these appraisers keep using these big discounts? Remember we talked about bias? And I mentioned this in passing, but let's see if you remember. What are most private company appraisals for? They're not for transactions. So let's take that off the table. What are most private company appraisals for? Why do they appraise the values of companies? I gave you two reasons. Let's see if you remember one of the two. One is?
Curiosity.
Curiosity is, but that's a small reason. It's an expensive way to kind of, so curiosity. But there are two actually very, very substantial reasons for appraisals that have consequences for you. First is taxes. You know when they get valued? It's when you have to pay, a person dies, you got to value the business. The IRS says, whatever value you come up with, I'm going to take 40% of that value. So that's the first context. The other is divorce court. Two very wealthy people get, or actually somebody like a Henry Ham, a private company, big oil company. You value the company, half of the value is going to go to your soon to be ex-spouse, who you don't even talk to anymore. So those are the two contexts in which you see most valuations, for tax court or for divorce court. So if you're a private company appraiser and I come to you and say, put a number on my company, I want to pay 40% of this number. Do I want that number to be a really high number or a really low number? I want that number to be as close to zero as I can get, right? Because I can go to the IRS and say, my business is worth nothing. Or I can go to my soon-to-be ex-spouse and say, half of nothing is nothing. Here's nothing. We're all even. Let's move on. Now do you see why appraisers like big discounts? And this was very convenient for them. They went to the court and said, look, we're not just making up the 35%. Look, we have a study to back it up. It's called the restricted stock study or an IPO study. It gave them this facade of, hey, these are facts. These are not judgments. I'm not biased. And that's a problem that I talked about right at the start of this class, how we use numbers and statistics in bad ways to justify bringing bias into valuation. For 25 years, private company appraisers got away with this. Why? Because the IRS was too cheap to pay for expert witnesses on their side. So the taxpayer paid for the expert witness who came up with these studies. Look, IPO study. Look, restricted stock study. Until about 15 years ago, where the IRS said, we're losing too much money. We've got to at least pay on one case, pay somebody to actually look at these numbers. So they hired this guy, you know, he's called Mukesh Bajaj. He came in and he looked at these restricted stock studies. And he then did a very clever thing. He said, what kind of company? So basically looked at the common characteristics of companies that did restricted stock issues. And then he looked at the sampling bias created by looking at only those companies. And he concluded that out of the 35% discount, about 25% was because of the types of companies that were raising restricted stock. The other 10% was due to liquidity. So he offered this to the court. Now, finally, the court has two numbers. 35%, which is what the private company appraiser is discounting the value by, and the IRS's expert is saying it should really be closer to 10%. And courts being courts, guess what they did? They went right down the middle, which is a lot of money you're leaving on the table. 22.5% discount is still... But this is where you're going if you're sloppy. And that's... So I remember right after that happened, I get this wave of emails from private company appraisers. And they say, will you do a study for us on the size of the liquidity discount? I don't do studies. I'm too lazy to do studies for other people. So I said, so basically, I just wanted to see what they wanted. I said, what do you want my study to find? They said, we want to back up this 35% discount. So I said, let me get this straight. You want me to do a study to justify a discount that you think is the fact? That's not called a study. That's called cooking the numbers to make it look like 35% is the right discount. And 95% of the research in liquidity discounts is contaminated for that reason. These are paid studies. So when you see these IPO studies or restricted stock studies, they're often like you know how NBA games are sponsored by Kia. Kia is never going to say buy a Hyundai instead or buy a Honda. They're biased because they're essentially sponsored studies by appraisers who want them to come up with a big number. So I'm going to and that's the sampling problem. And something that you have to, you're saying that was statistics. Why are we talking about statistics again? Because we have a problem with data. That's where we always go back to. It's a sampling problem. And that sampling problem makes both these restricted stock studies and IPO studies really suspect for me. Which leaves me in a bad place. Because if I'm not going to trust those studies, the question is how are you going to observe the liquidity discount? And I gave you a clue, right? With IBM, what did I say the liquidity discount was? The $5 on each side plus the bid-ask spread. If the bid-ask spread is my discount, I have a much larger sample of companies which are not biased. Every publicly traded stock has a bid price and an ask price. So about 15 years ago, this is a study I've been too lazy to update because the original raw data has kind of disappeared and I don't want to go looking for it. I took every publicly traded stock on the New York Stock Exchange. I took the bid price and the ask price. I came up with the spread. So let's say the spread is 50 cents between the bid and the ask price. I divided that 50 cents by the stock price. So let's say the stock price is $20. 50 cents divided by $20 gives me a 2.5% bid-ask spread as a percent of the price. I call that my liquidity discount for that stock, and I did this for every stock. So in a stock like IBM, the liquidity discount is 0.1%. On a small NASDAQ stock, it could be as high as 20 to 25%, because a 50-cent spread on a $2 stock is a 25% discount. I had a sample of almost, 6,000 companies. Then I ran a regression of that spread as a percent of the price, no longer a sample of like 50 strange companies, this is every publicly traded stock, against the revenues of every company, the amount of cash they had, because my argument was we have a lot of cash, there should be very little liquidity discount because I can cash out the company at any point in time, and how much trading volume there was in the stock. I came up with a regression across the entire sample. You think, what is that going to do for me? If I take that regression and plug in the numbers for a private company, the regression, the private company's revenues, the private company's cash as a percent of value, and in the trading volume, I put a trading volume of zero. I'm going to act like a private company is a public company that never trades. I'm going to come up with a predicted spread as a percentage of the price for that private business. I'm going to come up with a version of an illiquidity discount. In fact, remember that restaurant we valued last class? I took it and essentially tried all three approaches. The first one, I do what appraisers do. I call this the bludgeon approach, where basically you take a 25% discount, you put it in every company. I tried that. The second approach, I used that silver regression with the restricted stock, plugged in the fact that they had small revenues, and came up with a predicted discount of 28.75%. The first two approaches, I'm getting these really big discounts. But then I took my regression with the bid-ask spreads of publicly traded stocks, plugged in the numbers for the restaurant. The restaurant revenues are 1.2 million. It's so basically each of the variables reflect the regression equations, and I put in a zero for the trading volume. I came up with a predicted bid-ask spread for this company as a percentage of price of 12.88%. That's my estimate of the liquidity discount. It's not insubstantial. 12.88% is a pretty large amount, but it's much smaller than the 25 and the 28.75%. If you remember, the value that I came up for the equity in the restaurant was $521,000. I'm now going to knock off almost 12.88% from that value. And the value that I'd pay you as the chef owner of the restaurant is only $454,000. So think of how many times I've penalized you in this private-to-private transaction. First, I put in a salary into your income and lowered your income, right? Because why? Because I'm not a chef. So if I buy this restaurant, I've got to hire a chef. Second, I said I'm not diversified, so I had to push up my cost of equity for the fact that I wasn't diversified, so I used a much higher cost of capital. And third, because I'm putting all of my money into this restaurant, I'm worried about getting out if I wanted to, so I'm attaching a 12.88% discount. Now you can see why private company valuations lead you to much smaller numbers than are otherwise equivalent public companies. So any questions on the illiquidity discount? Okay? And there are some of you valuing public companies which are really closer to being private than public in terms of liquidity. And the things you should look at are numbers like the float. You know what the float is? The float is a percentage of shares in a company that are actually traded. Okay? You're saying, where are the other shares? They're held by insiders or owners who don't trade the shares at all. Even big companies like Facebook have low float. But the advantage they have is even though only 55% of the shares get traded, there's enough trading in that 55% that it makes up for the fact. There are some Indian companies which have floats of 1% to 2%. I don't even know why they're publicly traded. They're publicly traded only in name. The owner lists the shares, he gets a number, and then afterwards there's almost no trading. Those are companies that are really more private than public, and if you invest in those companies, you might have to do something like this to adjust the value for the fact that it's not liquid. Okay. Any questions on liquidity? Now let's move to the second scenario. This is a private company being sold to a publicly traded company. Let's see what's different about this. When you're selling a private company you're owner of a private company, I am a public company interested in buying you. First, what beta would you use in your valuation? Who's the buyer? A public company. Who owns the public company? Investors in the marketplace. Because they're investors in the marketplace, I can make the assumption that they're diversified, so I can go back to using a market beta. So I can replace my total beta with a market beta. So that discount goes away. You still have to adjust for the salary. That doesn't go away. But let me get to the liquidity part. Should I be attaching an illiquidity discount if I'm selling to a public company? What happens after the public company buys this restaurant? It goes into the public company. And if investors in the company want to get cash, what do? They just sell their shares. If you're part of a public company, the need for liquidity kind of dissipates because I can get my money out at any point in time by selling my shares. So in fact, I'm going to take my total beta and replace with the market beta. I'm going to and when I do that, my total beta replaces the market beta. My cost of capital, which was 13.25% with the total beta, drops back to what I'd have had as a public company. So my value is going to go up because I have a lower discount rate. Do you remember what the value was? $484,000 as a private company, right? Let's see what it is if a public company buys me. So if you look at it, the big changes are in the cost of capital. There's no liquidity discount. The value that I get for the same restaurant with a public buyer is almost $1.5 million. So I have two limiting numbers. The value of $454 million is what I get if I sell to another private buyer. I get a value of $1.5 million if I sell to a public company. Because the public company has investors who are diversified. And once you have investors who are diversified, the only risk you should focus on is the risk you cannot diversify away. So we revert back to a public company valuation. So what does it tell you if you're an owner of a private business? What do you get out of this? Who's your best potential buyer going to be? If you just look at a whole series of buyers, who's your best potential buyer in most cases going to be? It's going to be a public company rather than a private company. Does it mean you're going to collect $1.484 million? Let me ask you that practical question. As a private business, if you sold it to a private individual, it's $454,000. I'm a public buyer. We value the value, come up with the value of $1.484 million. So we're across the table from each other. You're the private owner of a business. I'm the public company manager trying to buy your business. Which number are you going to get? $454,000, $1.484 million, and some number in the middle. Let's start the negotiation. When you start the negotiation, what's the number you're going to start with that you claim your business is worth? Don't start with $454,000. You're dead, right? You're going to say, hey, you're a public company. You should be paying $1.484 million. What am I going to come back to you with? So you're a private business. You're illiquid. You're very risky. I'm going to come back with $454,000. Don't sit there saying, this is not fair. This is not fair. This is a negotiation. And who's going to win? If I'm the only public buyer in this process, I'm probably going to win, right? Because what are you going to do? Walk away? In which case, who are you going to sell to? Another private buyer who's going to pay. So if I offer you $500,000, it's much lower than the $1.484 million that I would get, but let's say that's the best I'm going to get. So as a seller of a private business, in addition to getting a private buyer interested or a public buyer interested, what do you need as your second piece in place? You need to get at least two public buyers interested, because then what can you do? You can play them off against each other and try to get as close to $1.484 million. There's also a very depressing afterthought here. You know how we like mom and pop businesses, right? Remember when Harry Met Sally, that movie? You probably haven't seen it. A movie about this private bookstore in Seattle run by Sally Fields? Or whatever it was, you know. It wasn't Sally Fields, it was somebody. And then this public bookstore tries to buy them, and the whole movie is about, you know, how great it is to have privately owned bookstores with the owners behind the counter. Let go of that sentimental attachment, because over time, public companies will drive out private businesses in business after business. I'll give you an example. 30 years ago, if you walked into a pharmacy in the U.S., 95% of the pharmacies in the U.S. were owned by the pharmacist standing behind the counter. They were privately owned businesses. Today, you walk into a pharmacy. You look up. What do you see? You're going to see Walgreens or CVS. This number is going to surprise you. Who's doing CVS here? Somebody's doing CVS. What were the revenues last year? $176 billion. $176 billion. Think about it. $176 billion. When I first saw that, I said, who the hell shops at CVS? What do you do? Go in and buy all your stuff at CVS? Maybe your food is in CVS? This is the wrong place to be shopping. But $176 billion? In the pharmacy space, that privately owned pharmacy, I live in a town where there's still one privately owned pharmacy. It just hangs on by its fingernails. Because CVS finds ways to undercut it in every conceivable way. It's only a matter of time before it goes away. And in business after business, that's exactly what you will see happening because of this disadvantage that a private buyer will face against a public. It's happening in medical practices. Increasingly medical practices, which used to be all, you know, you had a doctor's practice, the doctor owned the practice. Increasingly across the US, you're getting these public companies that bind together 20 or 25 practices. The doctor is now an employee of that practice. I mean, I live again in part of New Jersey, which is covered by Atlantic Healthcare, which basically covers almost every doctor within 50 miles of me. There are very few sole proprietorships left because, again, this is exactly what you will see happening over time. And it's not just the U.S. This is inexorable. Across the world, you're going to see public companies drive out private businesses. You will see private companies that hang on, either because they're niche businesses, where there's a personal component. I'll give you an example. There used to be this mystery bookstore downtown. It's called the Mystery Bookstore. And it's run by this guy who I think had read every single book in that bookstore. So he walked into the bookstore and said, I like Sue Grafton. And he said, you know what, I can give you three authors who are, you know, why don't you try it? Because he'd read every book. You walk into Barnes & Noble and say, I like Sue Grafton. You know what the cashier is going to say? That's nice. Why don't you get married to her? He has no idea who Sue Grafton is and why you're telling him this. The reason that guy hung on is even though he charged higher prices than everybody else, people were willing to go into the store because it was a personal component, niche businesses. He actually had to shut down this year because his lease ran out and the new lease was so much higher than the old one. He said, I can't take this. Or because you're a private business that essentially has grown to the point where you can be diversified without ever going public. You heard of Coke Industries and Cargill. These are very big private businesses, billions of dollars of revenues. They reached a point where they don't really face a disadvantage in the public marketplace. I'll end this part of the story. Every year, the MBAs do this auction where they auction off, you know, different services. The only thing I can offer in that auction is I value a company. You know, you come up with a company, I'll value it. And usually people actually bid for the auction, they win, they never seem to come to me with the company. They view it as charitable contributions, as if you don't pay enough in your tuition, you need to make more charitable contributions to the university. So about 4 years ago, somebody wins, and as usual, I expect nothing to come out of this. But the guy actually shows up with a valuation machine. He said, I'd like you to value my company. I won this auction for $2,000. And since he paid $2,000, I said, okay. Expecting some nice, small, compact business that I could value in 30 minutes. He comes in with like 5,000 pages of documents. It's a trolley he pulled in. He says, what the hell is this? He says, these are the numbers for my private business. I said, what kind of private business is this? He said, we manufacture rum. Thought in my stomach and my starts to. I said, where exactly are you from? He said, Miami. I said, okay, you manufacture rum, you're from Miami. Are you part of a big family? He says, a really big family. You know what his company was, right? Bacardi. He said, how come Bacardi is still private? If you keep sampling your own wares enough, you probably don't realize how much of a discount there is to being a private business. It's a huge private business. Eventually, the frictions will force them to go public. You know why? Because you have families that are now extending to, what, hundreds of people, and they all want to cash out because as part of a private business, you don't get the kind of, you know, $50 million payoff. Eventually, that happens, and private businesses will get this push to go public. Luis, the question? No? Okay. So let's now talk about initial public offerings. So let's say you want to do a valuation for an IPO. Let's see what's different and what's similar. Let's start with what's similar. When you value a company for an IPO, you can follow all the rules we talked about in valuing public companies, cash flows, growth rates, cost of capital. So I'm going to use an example. This was my Twitter pre-IPO valuation. And I've told you the story before. Every time a company is planning an IPO, the minute it files a prospectus, I do my valuation before they put an offering price. I did this with Snap and I did this with Twitter in October of 2013. So this is right after the IPO, the prospectus, the value that I came up with was about $17. It uses exactly the same kind of approach that I use for Amazon. I grew the revenues, adjusted the margin, so it looks just like my Amazon valuation, with a couple of differences. And I want to focus in on what I had to do differently when I valued Twitter that I did not have to do when I valued Facebook or Google after they became public companies. So at the time of the IPO, here are the issues that I had to deal with. The first is, when you do an IPO on the offering date, shares are issued to the public, they pay cash, cash comes into the company, right? You need to tell me what you plan to do with the cash before I put a value in your company. Because there are three things you can do with the cash. The first is, existing owners can sometimes cash out, so they can actually collect the cash and leave the company. The second is, you can use the cash to retire old debt or something you didn't want on the books. The third is, you can just hold on to the cash because you have other investments coming in the future. And almost every prospectus will tell you what the expected use of the proceeds are. I'll talk about why that affects value. The second is, by the time you go public, you have layers of equity in your company. What I mean by layers of equity is, each time a venture capitalist invests in a company like Twitter, they get their own terms. So when you look at the company and you look at the equity in the company, it's not 10 million shares all equal. There are five slices of equity, each of which has a different claim with options attached to them. Third, when you talk about the pricing issues, I talked about the fact that most IPOs, investment bankers guarantee a price and they try to deliver it, and you have to think about follow-up offerings. It's not the offering day, just the start of the dance. The end of the dance is 6 months, 1 year, 2 years later. So let's start with the proceeds. As I said, three things you can do with the proceeds. One is, you can take it out of the firm and give it to owners who want to cash out. The second is, you can use it to pay down debt that you might have taken earlier that you don't want to have in your books anymore. And the third is, you can hold on as cash. The easiest scenario is the cash leaves the firm, because then you can just ignore it. Nothing happens to your valuation. But if the cash is raised in the market and is kept as a cash balance, here's what's going to happen. The day after the IPO, your cash balance is going to jump by that cash, right? So if you raise $2 billion in the IPO, your valuation has to add the extra $2 billion on to come up with the value of the firm, which creates a bit of a circular reasoning, because you're trying to value the firm before the IPO. You don't know what the price per share will be. You still have to make a guess on how much the company plans to raise at the time of its offering. In the case of Twitter, here's what I had to do. At the time of that I did the valuation, October 5th, I checked the news stories, because almost every IPO, the company will tell you ahead of time how much cash they hope to raise on the offering day. So these are news stories, they could change. The initial estimate for Twitter was they were planning to raise about $1 billion from the IPO. From the offering day. They were planning to keep the cash, and if you looked at the prospectus, they were planning to keep the cash on the company's balance sheet to cover future investment needs. So if you go back and look at my valuation of Twitter, see this IPO proceeds of 1,000? That's the extra billion coming in on the offering date, now added to my value as a company. If you take a company like Alibaba, I think on their offering day, they raised, what, $4 billion that they planned to keep on as a cash balance. So the value of Alibaba had to be increased by $4 billion to reflect the inflow of cash. So the next time you look at an IPO, check the prospectus to see what the company plans to do with the cash, because it can have consequences for your valuation. So if Twitter had said in their prospectus that they were planning to let half this cash be withdrawn by the owners to cover, in fact, in the Facebook IPO, Mark Zuckerberg actually withdrew $500 million from the IPO proceeds. You know why? Because at the time of the IPO, the state of California assessed a tax because he had all these options outstanding that got exercised at the time of the IPO because they were converted to shares. He came up with about $1.5 billion in capital gains on the IPO date, on which he had $500 million in taxes due. So $500 million of the proceeds from the IPO he actually took out of the firm, covers tax needs. So when I had to value Facebook, I had to take all of the cash except for that $500 million and add it on to the value of the company. So sounds like double counting, but you have to keep track of the cash. If you have claims from other equity investors, you got to mop up. Remember, we talked about adjusting for options with public companies? Think of these as options on steroids. You have seven layers of options. You got to make sure you deal with those. And in fact, getting a share count on an IPO is actually really tough to do. If you get a chance, visit the Snap prospectus and tell me how many shares are going to be outstanding the date after the IPO, and you'll see exactly what I mean, because they had eight layers of shares that they'd issued to different VCs. They had restricted stocks outstanding, options outstanding. You have to decide what the actual share count is going to be. So here are the claims that Twitter had. The owners of the company owned the common shares. They had seven classes of convertible preferred shares. What does that tell you? They've had at least seven VC rounds before they went public. That's basically what you get, seven convertible. They had 86 million restricted stock units that they've used to pay people along as they grew. They had 44.16 million options outstanding. And they also had done an acquisition just before their IPO where they'd agreed to pay for that acquisition with more shares outstanding. So when I did the share count for Twitter, I counted everything but the restricted stock units and the options, 472.61. I brought in the restricted stock units as well into my number of shares, because just because they're restricted doesn't mean they're not out there. So when I had to do my share count for Twitter, I had to make sure that I got all of these shares into my share count. Only way this will not be an abstraction is just pick up a prospectus for any company. Just go into the SEC filings place, type in Twitter, Snap, you'll find their original prospectus. Just take a look at it. It's a good exercise in understanding how getting to a number of shares outstanding can itself be a potential problem. Now let's talk about the investment banking guarantee. As the investment banker, I offer you a guarantee. It's a kind of meaningless guarantee because I also set the price. It's like a retailer guaranteeing you a price, but not telling you what that price is. I'll guarantee you a fixed price. Hey, you can guarantee me a fixed price if it's 50% higher than everybody else's. So the investment banking guarantee is more for you to feel good about this process as an issuing company. But because the price guarantee is the investment banker's responsibility, if they're going to make a mistake, as Louis pointed out, it's better to underprice than to overprice. And the way this manifests itself is basically that your job is a pricing job, not a value job. And we already talked about this in the context of Twitter. When I talked about pricing, the way Twitter was priced was not with a discounted cash flow model, but with the pricing. And what I mean by that, it's very, very, very simple. Here's what the investment banks did. They called portfolio managers, and they said, we're planning to take Twitter public. We're thinking about a $22 share price. What do you think of that price? If you're extremely enthusiastic about the price, I hang up the phone, so I'll call you back later. And I call you about 2 days later, and I say, how about a $26 price? You're still way too enthusiastic. I call you again in another 2 days. So basically, it's almost like you're gauging demand by putting a price out, seeing how much there is. Okay? But that's their job. Investment banks price IPOs because they have to take these companies public at that price. And if you look at a company like Twitter, I don't care what the DCF value is. And that's why when the offering price was set at 26, and I got called saying, well, what do you think about bankers doing? They have a very different job than I do. I was valuing the company. They were pricing the company. It's entirely possible to get two very different numbers for an IPO based on what hat you're wearing. So when you look at actual IPOs, IPOs are underpriced on average. So this is actually the percent, if you look at the proceeds of the IPO, the percentage underpricing, really small IPOs, on average are underpriced by about 16%. So this is basically what happened to the offering date, that jump in the price. But even bigger IPOs, $500 million, $1 billion, $5 billion, $10 billion IPOs, see pricing. So basically, that's the offering date jump, the 10, 15, 20%. And that's what makes people's eyes light up about IPOs. They say, if I could just get in on every IPO, I could make money. And we talked about why this doesn't work. You try to apply for every IPO, 1,000 shares, you're going to get 1,000 shares in every bad IPO and maybe 100 shares in the good IPOs. There's an article over the weekend about how preferred clients for investment banks often get shares in IPOs. Now, I remember when I was when the Facebook IPO came out, Roy Smith, you heard of Roy Smith. Roy teaches the investment banking class. He's taught it for a long time. And he used to be managing director at Goldman Sachs. He used to head their international operations before he came back to Stern, after he retired to teach. So, of course, Goldman is one of the bankers in the Facebook IPO. So Roy gets an offering from that he can buy 1,000 shares because he's a preferred client. So he comes into my office and says, did you get the preferred offering? I said, Roy, I'm not a preferred client and I don't want to be one. Because preferred clients, there's a set of whole set of costs associated with being a preferred client for an investment bank. They expect you to trade through them. They expect you to take their advice. I'm not sure the net you come out ahead, but on things like IPOs, you do get a leg up because you get that preferred allotment that might be 1,000 shares in an underpriced IPO. And finally, on the offering quantity, the key thing to remember is this is not the end of the game. This is the beginning of the game. That's why the way in which IPOs get priced. In fact, when I started doing finance as part of the PhD program, you look at the IPO studies. It was called the IPO puzzle. Why do bankers underprice IPOs? Why do founders go along? And the presumption there was that companies offer 100% of their shares at the offering day. And that used to be the case pre-1990. When companies went public, a bigger chunk of the shares used to be offered on the offering day. So when Microsoft and Apple were underpriced, a significant amount of money was left on the table. That's changed. I think Snap offered, 9% of its shares on the offering day? Facebook was 12%. We're talking about 9, 10, 12% of the shares, so there's a lot more to come. And to many founders, this is the opening volley in a very long fight. So they view this as, hey, that's okay. If I get good publicity, I get that good article in the Wall Street Journal, that's going to help me on my subsequent cases. So let's close by looking at a final type of transaction. You run a private business. Most private businesses don't go public in one step. They have to go through intermediate steps. And in most cases, here's what happens. You start a business. Initially, almost entire capital comes from the owner. Well, you have no choice. It's your startup. As you approach your first need, you approach what are called angel VCs. These are VCs who invest in really young companies. They tend to be very sector-focused. They invest only in social media companies or only in computer software companies. You approach them. The next stage in the process, you approach some bigger VCs who are more diversified than the angel VCs. And then in the final stage, if everything works out, you go public. You think, so what? Let's take a very simple example. Let's assume you're in a business where the market beta is 1. And initially, you're the owner. So basically, you're completely undiversified. And the correlation of your portfolio of the stock with the market is only 25%. So basically, your total beta is 4. Because as an owner, you get exposed to all risk. That beta 4 gives you a cost of equity of 24%. So those first 2 years, when it's all your money, your cost of equity is huge. But as you build your spreadsheet, at the end of 2 years, you expect that you have to go to the VCs to collect more money. Let's say those angel venture capitalists have a higher correlation than you. Why? Because they don't put all their money in one business. At least they spread across 20. So let's say their correlation is 0.5. See what's going to happen? Even though the beta hasn't changed, your total beta is going to go from 4 to 2. Why? Because the investors investing in the company now are more diversified than you were. Final stage in the process, you go public. You're now going to use a market beta. So your beta went from 4 to 2 to 1. Not because your company got safer, but because the marginal investor changed over time. So when I build a discounted cash flow valuation for this company, here's what's going to happen. I do my cash flows, but the discount rate I'm going to use is going to be the 24% I got as a private owner for the first 2 years. It's going to drop to 14% for the next 3 years when the venture capitalist is the marginal investor, and then it's going to drop even further to 9% when I become a public company. So to value this private business, you can already see that my discount rate is going to change, which is going to create some compounding consequences. But here's what I get. If I value the firm correctly by allowing the discount rate to change over time, I get a $1.5 million value. If I value the company using my 24% cost of equity forever, I'm going to significantly undervalue the company. It's a mistake I see in startup company valuations all the time, where the startup founder will project out the cash flows, put a 20% discount rate, and all the cash flows in perpetuity. You're giving away too much. That shouldn't be happening if you have an expectation that the investors in your company will change. And in fact, if I go to the other extreme and use my 9% cost of equity, I'm going to overvalue the company. With young companies, we expect changes to happen to the investor base. That's what you should expect to have. So let me close off. Two basic propositions about valuing private businesses. The value of a private business will be greater if I see an exit into the public marketplace. So what does that even mean? You have a privately owned social media company, I'm going to attach a much higher value than if you own a privately owned bookstore. Privately owned social media companies have a much greater chance of going into the public marketplace. Privately owned companies in markets which have very good where it's easy to go to the market like the US, should be worth more than private companies in Latin America, where it's so much more difficult to get a pathway into the public marketplace. Private company valuations, where the transitions are going to happen, those transitions will be worth, so as you go through those transitions, if you look at two companies, one of which you expect to make transitions to VC and public, the company that makes the transitions will be worth more than a company that you don't expect to make the transitions. I know some of you are valuing private businesses, and when you turn the initial DCF, I allowed you to use a public company cost of capital. You might want to go back and finesse that a little bit, because as private businesses, your discount rate might be higher today. So when you think about private businesses, if you ask me what the if I ask you to value a private business, what's the first question you need to ask me? Why? To whom? Why? Because motive matters. Is it curiosity? Is it for taxes? Is it for divorce court? To whom? Because a buyer matters. The value is going to be different. And when you come up with the value for the private company, keep your eyes on all of those things, because as they change, your value for the private business will change as well. So if any of you have family businesses or friends who have businesses, okay, don't do it during the class. You have enough in this class for the next 4 weeks. But after you're done with the class, try it out. Try valuing a private business. It's actually a great way to make sure you understand the basics of valuation. So on Wednesday, we're going to start with option pricing. How many of you remember your option pricing from your foundations class? Be honest. So here's what I'm going to do. On Wednesday, I'm going to assume that you remember nothing. You say, I don't even know what an option is. I'm just going to assume nothing, and I'm going to build on that because that's a good place to get started. Yeah.
I choose the eBay drive by EBITDA for the cash flow dead part, and I did a regression and I said eBay drive by EBITDA. And then I got the
screening, you're trying to do this math by putting floors and ceilings. Regression, you're letting the regression kind of take care of it. There are two different ways. One is... Nothing you can do. You have the data that you do. So that's just capital IQ is missing data. It's not like I held back the data. The data is just not there. And that's your choice. You have to decide what to do with it. Hey, how are you? Good.
I sent in my H&M valuation a few times on my first DCF, and I sent it as a Google Drive and responded to me sent it back as another one. And
you never
so
got it back?
No, I didn't. Okay. It was so big, I sent it as a zip, so I assumed you just didn't
I think I opened yours up. It was like 35 meg or something by the time it was done, right?
Yeah. I think I opened it. When I downloaded it, it started at 25 meg. Yeah.
Let me check. Well, there were some macros built into it and stuff. I don't know what happened.
Maybe my computer automatically has some macros in it that's making it so big. But I know most of the comments and feedback is pretty fast.
I'll check. In fact, I remember going through the valuation. I don't know whether...
Oh, okay.
I might have tried to send it back, but because I tried to send it back as an attachment, it might have stopped it because there's a limit on how big the attachments are within Stern that you can send out. So what I'll do is I'll go through the spreadsheet and I'll actually put the comments without the attached spreadsheet and send them first, and then I'll send the attachments after.
I know most of it's just based off of, I chose a growth rate of 3%. Yeah. I mean, basically last year it was 6%, but when I look at the return on capital and the reinvestment...
What did you do to the margins?
They're 15, they go to 13%. Okay. I mean, it just says...
I think retailing, the big question is... What is? Are we on the Matan death march, which is our old retailers going to see lower growth and lower margins? You are building in lower growth, low growth, and lower margins.
Yeah.
And the story is plausible and it's probably even probable. The question is, why 13?
The valuation is actually good. Like, even with the 3% growth rate looking forward, it's higher than the market value right now.
No part of that story that I find implausible. Basically, the revenue growth looks like it's something I could live with because it's collectively you're saying they can at least keep track with overall retail revenue growth.
Yeah.
And the margin declining is consistent with what's happening in the sector.
Yeah.
So the story's
a 3% decline, but I mean...
So that's your big assumption. That's what your valuation is going to rest on. It's not the revenue growth number. It's what you think the end margin is going to be. If you think the competition is going to become stronger, obviously your valuation is going to start to implode on you. So okay. There's a number you're going to stress test. It's a 13% margin.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi, how are you?
I'm valuing Pandora.
Yeah.
And you said...
Pandora Media?
Yes.
Yeah.
And you said when you responded to my comments that the valuation seemed plausible. However, it was worthless because I got a negative stock price. So I went through all of the diagnostics listed. I've played around with the numbers a lot, and I... the largest stock price I've gotten is like 27 cents.
I'd say review again what I found about your valuation that was worthless.
Okay.
So basically what were you assuming? That revenues won't grow and margins won't change.
Right.
So why are you doing the valuation?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, in a sense, if that's your story, the value is going to be... So I'm saying if your story is to begin with that that this is a company whose revenues will not change much and its margins are not going to improve over time, then your value is kind of predetermined.
Right.
So the valuation is kind of just going to fill in. So my point about the valuation is your story is so negative about the company, your valuation reflects it. So I'm not saying you have to change your valuation.
Okay.
I'm just saying given your story, it's almost pointless putting a value on it because your story is... I didn't even have to look at your DCF. All I had to do was read your story and say, you're going to find a negative value.
I didn't expect it, but just like everything I saw pointed towards that.
That's fine. If that's your reasonable story, put a zero equity value from the DCF. And say, based on my story, I think the company is going to be worth nothing, which means you obviously will not buy the company.
Okay.
You put a sell on the company. Right. That's perfectly okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hi. So I had a question, like my group for the mystery project.
Yeah.
So when we're valuing, like when we're trying to understand like which stocks in the portfolio are overvalued versus undervalued,
mm-hmm.
What we were trying to do was find like the fundamental value and the market value.
What do you mean fundamental value?
So we would try to...